If you have a green thumb or have always wanted one, then get ready for Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, along with George Allman. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas, help solve problems, and keep you up to date on the latest developments in the nursery and landscaping industry. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. We are well into January of the new year at this point. Unfortunate situation up in Los Angeles with the fires. It's almost unbelievable what took place up there. But it was interesting. I was doing some research after the fires, and I found an article from there's so much information out anymore that it's almost too much information. I found an article in 2015 where researchers over in Europe, I think predominantly Spain and Portugal, were studying the use of Italian cypress as a fire break or to slow the spread of wildfire. And they were looking at different plantings of it and things like that. All the information that you find in the United States, don't plant Italian cypress because it's a problem, mm-hmm. and it will burn. And one of the articles, and I think it was from it originated up in Oregon, showed a stand of Italian cypress, and the person that wrote the article said that these Italian cypress burned in such and such a fire, and it caught my parents' house on fire. But only about a third of the Italian cypress was burned, and about 2/3 to 3/4 of the tree trees were left. Now, when I'm looking at that, and I'm not a firefighter or expert in combustible materials, but that doesn't seem like a really good fuel if that much of the tree was left. I could see where if it may have caught fire if it was close to somebody's house or under an eave or next to a fence or some or a wooden structure. But it would seem to me that if it was, like, based on my experience going through the burn areas here in San Diego in 2003 and then again in 2007, when you found a plant that was a fuel, it was gone. There was nothing left of it.
Right.
So I'm thinking what I can see where the interest over in Europe is to use these as a fire break, mm-hmm. even if they catch fire, but they mm-hmm. catch the embers or slow the spread of it. But anyway, there's no definitive information on it that I can find. And like I said, the information from the Smithsonian in Europe is one thing. The information in the United States, mostly California and Oregon, is another. I reached out to a good friend of mine who lives up in Napa, who used to own a nursery up there, but he was also the chief of the Santa Elena Fire Department, and to ask him what his opinion on it is. I have not heard back from him yet.
When you were telling me about this morning, I was anxious for John to come in to see what his opinion might have been, because you've been, mm-hmm. doing this for a long time.
Yeah, I've been at it a long time. I also own property in Julian, so try to get fire insurance. It's very difficult, and it just regularly burns.
But yeah,
I'll tell you, there are two prevailing schools of thought, and unfortunately, as you're saying, this second school of thought gets very little notice, and that is that plant fire breaks with plant material along the margins of your property, on the apron of your property, because that catches the embers. So, most CDF and Cal Fire, they say clear everything 200 feet from your house. Well, then what is in the way of the embers?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And where the embers go is they hit your house. Mm-hmm. And there's a very interesting institute. It's called Chaparral Institute. Richard Halsey. He's an acquaintance of mine, and we should have him on the show.
That would be a good one.
Because here's the way they say it. You want to plant plantings, not right next to your house, but you want them all around your house, that catches the embers. And if that burns, fine, but it's catching the embers rather than your house being the sole thing in the way of embers.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so it's their thinking is you actually should be planting intentionally around your property and not clear cutting everything around. So I know, you know, and he gets a lot of buy-in from guys that are in the fire departments, but that's not the party line anyway.
And when, excuse me, when you're talking about those plants that you would plant as breaks, obviously there would be some that would be more susceptible to being, you know, being a fuel.
Yeah, don't do the creosote bush.
Right. You know?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Something there's that's going to hold a lot of moisture, something that's going to be
a high moisture content.
Exactly. Right. It won't burn quickly.
Exactly. Now, after the cedar fire in 2003, I was talking to my friend because he and one of his strike teams actually came down from Santa Elena to help fight that fire. And after the fires were out, I called him up and was talking to him because he owned a nursery too. So I said, we have a lot of customers are asking about fire-wise planting and things like that. I said, you know, what can we tell our customers to do in this type of a situation? And he said, you know what you need to do in that kind of a situation? He said, is get out. He said, because there isn't, he said, when you have a fire like that, he said, it doesn't matter what you do.
Right.
He said, it's not going to stop it. He said, it's going to barrel through. And I actually went to a house up in High Valley.
It was the one right across the street from our house.
Yeah.
It's not there anymore. There's a new house that's in its place.
But the gentleman that had built the house, it was right on the canyon, right on the edge of the canyon and on a little promontory. The house was surrounded by avocado groves. And I went to survey his landscape for damage. This was in 2007. This was the Witch Creek fire. And he was telling me that when he built his house, that he did everything that he could to make his house fire resistant or fireproof. And he said the newspaper even came out and ran articles about everything that he did. His house was gone. I mean, there was nothing left of it. It was, by the time I got there, which was maybe a week or two after the fire, the only thing that was left was the slab. Mm. Everything else was gone. All of his avocados were gone. I mean, it was just incredible. But that there again, though, it's basically a firestorm, and you're really not going to be able to do much.
Did he have cementitious siding and metal roof?
I'm assuming that it was probably a concrete tile roof, stucco outside. But I have also read too that one of the ways you can have a house from the exterior that's pretty fire resistant. But if the fire gets close enough to the house that it heats the glass in the windows, then the windows break, and then the fire moves indoors and starts, and it burns from the inside out.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. So the windows break, the blinds or the drapes catch on fire, and then it just spreads through the interior of the house that way. So the house will burn from the inside out.
Where the house that you were speaking of that was lost, a lot of homes up there were lost in that.
Yeah, there
fire.
Were
very few remained.
Yeah,
but this is going to renew interest in firewise planting, I think. Yes. And a couple of years ago, we had Greg Rubin.
Oh yeah, sure.
He does a lot of firewise planting, and so maybe he might be someone we can bring in and certainly do another class or two. I think there's going to be a renewed interest in that, in what to plant and how to plant.
Well, you know, I've seen some articles where they talk about planting. Where they talk about planting native species and things like that. Well,
those burn too.
Yeah, they do. they absolutely do.
Many of them need to burn. So
yes, they do.
They're
accustomed to burning.
Right. Yeah. You know, after the cedar fire, east of Interstate 15, that was all native. Mm-hmm. And after the cedar fire, that was all ash. Mm-hmm. There was nothing left of it at all.
That's a fire regenerated biome. You know, these things need 400 degree temperatures to even have their seeds pop. So they're used to it. And native planting is not the secret either.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I think it was on Nova on PBS. This goes back to, remember when they had that really, really bad wildfire in Yellowstone, almost burned the lodge down. They did a documentary about that and about that fire and fire in general in the National Park Service and things like that. And this goes back well over 100 years where this policy was in place. Once they started creating national parks, the theory of the Department of the Interior was people don't want to come and see a burned up park. Right. So the mantra was, if a fire starts for any reason, put it out as soon as possible. And this included lightning strikes and things like mm-hmm. that. Well, by doing that, it interrupted the natural
fire cycle.
Natural fire cycle of the forests. Mm-hmm. And consequently, forests became overgrown. They became unhealthy, overcrowded. The trees would grow. They would get choked out by other trees in the area. Just too much density. Those trees would die, fall on the ground, and just leave fuel behind. And it got to after 100 years, it's like, how do you even catch up with it at that point? You know, there's just it's too big of a job to try to go out. So they were talking about how they really need to reevaluate what their policy is. And if it's a man-made fire, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But if it's a naturally occurring fire, but now the problem is even a naturally occurring fire now is going to be far worse than it would have been under if everything had been left to,
well, it's going to stay. It remains in place longer. It's going to burn hotter and longer at trees that it normally would just bypass because it was moving quickly because there wasn't enough fuel to sustain it.
Exactly.
But when the big cedar fire hit on Mount Cuyamaca, you know, we went from 200 Cuyamaca cypress down to 40 in the world. You know, and a lot of the there were some Douglas fir on that mountain and a few other more exotic species. But it hadn't burned in 100 years.
Yeah.
And so it is so over dense and built up that then when it does burn, it's not that light, easy fire that is not intensely hot. It's a firestorm.
Right. And exactly.
So that's the problem.
Yeah.
And I went to San Pedro Martir Mountain in Baja with a naturalist, and he said, you don't see in Baja, same habitat that we have, same plant, ecosystem. Same ecosystem in those mountains. He said, that naturally burns. They're not putting fires out. And when the fires start, they burn at a very low temperature, and they just work through an area, and they kind of put themselves out. Here, they have suppressed it for so long that then it just explodes.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's much that you can do about it at that point. So. Yeah. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We were talking about the fires up in LA and just how horrible that was. But it reminded me, growing up as a kid, of the Laguna Fire. And a lot of people, I think, have forgotten about that and just how horrendous of a fire that was. It burned for almost 2 weeks was it September and October?
September 22nd to October 4th of 1970.
Yeah, and I remember growing up in Bay Park. Well, my neighbor, she was certain that this was the beginning of the end of the world because the fire was so bad and it just raged through the East County, burned all the way up to El Cajon, and I think almost to Spring Valley too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a tremendous fire. But I remember standing in my front yard and the smoke overhead and the ash, just huge chunks of ash falling out of the sky. It was like snow. Mm-hmm. It was everywhere. And it was like that for days.
It was bad. And I remember that the ash was so heavy, it ruined people's cars where the paint was ate through the paint. My dad had a 69 Cadillac Coupe DeVille. Mm-hmm. No, it was a sedan DeVille, the four-door. Mm-hmm. And he headed outside and he goes, oh, mother of God. He runs outside and there was just ash all over it, and it actually had eaten through the paint.
Yeah, you said that was the second largest fire
at the time. It was the second largest fire in California history at the time, obviously.
175,000 acres burned.
175,000, yeah.
But you know, part of the difference between that fire and the fires today is nobody lived here then.
Well, right? density yes. is a big factor. Yeah, so when we do say that this factor. Much, you know, it's one mm-hmm. of the most expensive fires in history, or floods, or mm-hmm. hurricanes, a lot of the cost is A, inflation, and B, is population, mm-hmm. right? There's new infrastructure that's been destroyed that wasn't there the last time there was a flood, fire, or hurricane.
Yeah. Yeah. And now after the fires, there's going to be a lot of landslides and earth movement and things like that. But one thing I've always found interesting, and I've never really heard a definitive answer on it, is after a fire burns through an area, say it's a natural growth area, a natural habitat, the top of the plants will burn off, but the root system is still there. Mm-hmm. And it's the roots that hold the soil in place. Mm-hmm. So I could see where you could get surface runoff, but I can't wrap my head around the fact that there's going to be a big landslide, because all the stuff that was holding the land in place before the fire mm-hmm. is still underground mm-hmm. and holding it there. So I don't know the mechanics of that myself.
Put on my botanist hat for a second. One of the more interesting aspects of plant physiology in places that are fire regenerative biomes is lignotubers. Isn't that a great word?
Lignotuber. That's a new one for me.
We had that for dinner last night.
And Australia, which has a very similar fire cycle that we have here. Mm-hmm. Many of their plants also require fire to cause the sea.
One of the five Mediterranean climates,
yes,
right?
And, mm-hmm. and when I'm breeding Banksias, I actually have to put them in a barbecue, get them hot so that the seeds pop out. So it's mm-hmm. it's very similar to what we have. And, you know, it if you see like a Corymbia fissifolia, I was in Pacific Beach working on a job. There is like a giant ball at the base of that tree. That's the lignotuber.
You have to explain what that is. What is that tree?
It's a type of small eucalyptus that's okay. gorgeous. So many eucalyptus have lignotubers, and many plants that are native to California have lignotubers. And so in a fire, that can even completely burn away. And that little ball that's rooted into the ground will literally resprout, and a new plant comes from that, or a whole new tree. So that's a really interesting part of plant physiology. And so I think we underestimate how much our natural environment wants fire. And mm-hmm. so, but the problem is, as you said, George, we are all moving into where was previously rural areas. And now that urban natural interface is becoming very blurred.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where do people want to build a house? On the hill, where the fire runs up the hill and burns your house.
Yeah, that is true. So we'll, through as time goes on, as we get more information and new stuff comes to light, we'll be sure to let everybody know. We do have classes today in both stores in San Diego at 9:00. It's going to be bare fruit trees with Chris, and at 9:30 in Poway, it's going to be blueberries with Richard Wright.
Correct.
So you can come in and check both of those out. We are in the middle of bare fruit tree season. Things are moving very quickly. So if you want to get, and same thing with roses, we're already selling out of roses. So
I haven't checked for this week, but as of last week, we had sold about a third of the bare root fruit trees that we brought in 3 weeks.
And we brought in a lot.
Right. Yeah. A third of them are gone.
Yeah. So don't wait. If you're thinking about putting something in your yard, you best get in and get it. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait till next year. Grow Power Plus is back in stock in both stores.
Finally.
So that's just the first of it. We've been in constant communication with the new owners of Grow Power, and they're working very diligently to get things moving and get things back in the stores. So Grow Power Plus is the first one. There's going to be more, within the next month or two, hopefully, as they bring everything back online again. So
another word on fertilizer. Can I tell you, Walter Anderson's is, I think, the only location where I can get Milorganite anymore.
Really?
Yeah. It's just not available anywhere. And I love Milorganite. Nice 640, gentle, can't burn, you know, and for just general use. If you people say, oh, I don't need to fertilize. Let me tell you something. Every grower who grows plants, fertilizes. And so you need to fertilize. And so in a general landscape setting, if you've got Raphiolepis kind of bank parking lot plants, just general things, I love Milorganite. And it's very economical, and only place I know of now you can get it is Walter Anderson's Nursery.
Well, we used to sell a lot more of it than we did. And then for a while, I think it was about, I want to say about 30 years ago, there was some controversy with it came up mm-hmm. where they were saying that you shouldn't use it in around anything that's edible because of the heavy metals. And I remember Milorganite did a lot of research on it, and they said, no, that's... Mm-hmm. That's wrong. It's not a problem, but they were trying mm-hmm. to pin it on, health side effects on it.
Yeah.
Because it's sewer
poo. Yeah. It's sludge. Sewer sludge.
Yeah.
Sewage sludge.
Yeah.
It used to be brewery waste it was started as the Milwaukee Organic Fertilizer Company. And they would take old, because where are all the beer breweries?
They were in the Milwaukee.
Beers that made Milwaukee famous. Right. Yeah. I don't think it's anymore, but that's, was the original source of that fertilizer. And then they thought, we don't have as many breweries. What else can we put in our fertilizer? And it became sewage sludge. And I don't worry about it because they heat it up to 900 degrees.
Oh, they cook it.
Cook it. And so I really like it. It's a very gentle, very inexpensive fertilizer. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're buying boxes of EB Stone to do your garden, it's mm-hmm. going to get expensive really yeah. fast.
When I lived in Japan, they called that night soil.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. If we can anchor here for a minute, because we are at the end of January, mm-hmm. what is your normal fertilization schedule now as we move forward? Is this the time we should be fertilizing our fruit trees, or do we wait till February? What do you normally do?
Well, that depends. So I met with a client this week and new person, and I said, your fruit trees don't look so hot. And he said, really? Oh, I fed them. And I said, really? When'd you feed them? Last year, spring of last year. And I said, okay, listen, fruit trees want three times a year. Mm-hmm. And so here's what I do. So I told him I'd do it now, but I would use something like Milorganite, or I would use EB Stone, Dr. Earth, some natural organic fertilizer, because it will wake up as the soil warms and it's available to the plant. And that way you aren't going to forget. Because you know what the biggest problem is, George and Ken? People forget to do it.
It sits on the shelf in the garage.
It sits on the shelf.
That's what I tell people and say, what's the best fertilizer? I said, the one you use.
The one you use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any of them, as long as you use it.
And plants have no eyes. They do not read. And so whether it says rose fertilizer, fruit tree fertilizer, you know, we have so many exotic mixtures of things. Just use a good fertilizer, but use it.
Yeah.
Just don't leave it in the garage. So I like to do this. I'm old, and so I like to have these little mnemonic devices to help me. I like St. Patrick's Day because, you know, luck of the Irish, put that out. Then 4th of July, put fertilizer on them again. And then Labor Day. And so, you know, when you're out having your beer for 4th of July, think, wait a minute, I got to fertilize. So it just helps to remember. And so, and sometimes if you attend a class at Walter Anderson Nursery, we'll remind you mm-hmm. to go do that. And again, go do it today after the class so you don't forget, because people forget.
Well, Melanie keeps a calendar on the pantry door and in the kitchen, and anything that we're doing, she marks it down. If we have concert tickets, they get stuck on the calendar so that we know where everything is. And if you're one of those people that keeps a calendar, or even if you keep a calendar on your computer, which mm-hmm. is where I keep my work calendar, make a note of it.
Yeah.
Just go and if you're doing it on a computer, hit the repeat button, you know, so that it pops up every, you know, whatever interval it is. Grow Power is, I think it's 6 to 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. So just make a note of it and remind yourself. Because mm-hmm. like I said, the best fertilizer is the one that you use.
Well, Melanie's like Capri, everything is on a calendar. So we, concerts, et cetera, so we don't forget. But I don't do my fertilizer that way. Mm. But that brings me to another point with regard to fertilizer. Mm. That's for your general purpose. You just said, you know, what about like nuanced stuff like your citrus? Because I know you're a big fan of zinc and iron and other things, magnesium. Do you do that quarterly, annually? How do you do that?
Well,
and we'll talk more about citrus later in the year, but I'm just curious from a feeding this time of year.
Right. This time of year, I really do like the idea. Again, if you're going to have fruit trees, feed them for Pete's sake. So I would do it now. If you haven't done it in a year or two, put it on now. Get an organic fertilizer and it will be available as the plant needs it, because frankly, I would have liked to have had people fertilize in fall, because what I want is, when do all citrus get all their leaves and all their flowers for the whole year? It's coming up couple of weeks. Late January, February is it. And if you didn't fertilize last year, you know, it's like asking your car to run on fumes. So do it.
Yeah.
And then get back in that cycle. But so I would do that now while people are thinking about it. Just go ahead and do it right now. And then all the nuance, you really want to put iron sulfate on your protease. I'd do that maybe on St. Patrick's Day. So you're thinking again, certain days.
Yeah.
But a lot of subtleties.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have to have a whole show just to that.
Yes. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. As of the first of the year in California, neonics have been banned. The most common one that was out there was imidacloprid. Mm-hmm. Absolutely amazing product.
As a systemic insecticide.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the state felt that it was time to get rid of it for homeowner use, for mm-hmm. agricultural and commercial use. If you're a licensed applicator, it is still available. Mm-hmm. But this has been something that's been coming for some time. And one of the biggest manufacturers, BioAdvance, which used to be Bayer mm-hmm. AgriScience, we sold more of their product than anybody else's. They still make some very fantastic stuff. But Home Depot and Lowe's made the decision to stop carrying neonics some time ago. I want to say probably about 7 or 8 years ago.
Well, when they sold their fruit trees, they had it for years. They had a tag that mm-hmm. said this plant or this tree has been treated with an FDA approved systemic insecticide, and it was a neonic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so do all of our citrus has that.
But they had that tag on it, and people saw that, and I think they rebelled against it, which was probably part of the impetus mm-hmm. is why those stores stopped selling them.
Yeah. So they eliminated the sale of neonics, but they needed something to sell their customers. So Bayer, I think it was Bayer at that time, shifted a formulation over, and instead of imidacloprid, they started putting acephate, which is orthine, which was one of the go-to systemics many, many years ago. And then I thought it had been banned in California, and that's why it disappeared. But it disappeared, and has since now it's making a resurgence. Smells terrible.
It's nasty. One
of the worst smelling organophosphates that's out there. It's a very good product, but mm-hmm. it doesn't work the same way that that imidacloprid did. Mm-hmm. So the systemics that you see out there now, if you look at the label, are probably all going to be acephate. Mm-hmm. But there were other systemics. We were talking about it before we came on the air. Saigon.
Used to come in a
steel container.
Yes.
Yeah, in a steel can, twist top steel can. And I remember as a kid, growing up in the business, talking about systemics, and you typically didn't use systemic insecticides on edibles. But Saigon was labeled for citrus. Mm-hmm. You could use Saigon on citrus. Mm-hmm. I do remember that.
Boy, you're bringing back such sweet memories, Ken. And do you remember that all of these horrible, I mean, truly noxious organophosphates and things would come in brown glass bottles?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. It was like in my dad's garage. It was like a pharmacopoeia of poison. You just row upon row of these glass bottles. And I was actually working in the garage once and sweeping things up, and the broom handle went up, knocked a bottle of Orthonex off the shelf. That glass bottle exploded, and all that stuff went in my face and in my eyes. And that was not a pleasant experience.
No.
And so we've come a long way.
You know, I look back on what, how we used to stock our stores with the glass bottles, and thank God there was never a bad earthquake.
Oh my God.
That would turn any garden center into a Superfund site. I mean, it was unbelievable. Everything was in glass, even gallons of Malathion. Yes. in glass bottles. So
it's like, is that apple cider or is it?
but those were those dark brown.
Yeah. But you know, here's the dilemma though, too. It's really frustrating. You know, they've just removed it from use for homeowners, mm-hmm. but licensed applicators are still putting it out there. Commercial, so it's still in the environment, still being used by agriculture and by commercial growers. And so it's the law of unintended consequences when it comes to governmental regulation. I'm a bit of a, can I say it? I'm a little bit of a libertarian. I'm a real libertarian. And here's the thing. I just did some work with a tree guy. I had him come out and remove a tree and grind a stump. You know that in California, arborists can't use gas-powered chainsaws anymore, right? That's now against the law.
I heard something about
that. And so they use battery powered. And he said, here's the problem now. That chainsaw weighs 5 to 8 pounds more. He says, now we're all getting carpal tunnel syndrome. He says, we can barely hold the chainsaws. You're in a tree strapped in and you're up cutting things away. And he said, they're all battery powered. Well, the battery power is not enough to get through a single tree. So they're changing batteries every 15 minutes or so. So he said, you know, they made us do this because of the exhaust from a chainsaw. And now he says, you see that truck running over here? Giant box truck, diesel powered. Mm-hmm. He said, we leave the truck running all day long because we have to charge the batteries to trim the trees. And he says, so was it better to have a little chainsaw emitting a bit of two-cycle exhaust or to have a giant truck that's running all day long that's diesel powered? So overreach sometimes is very bad.
You know, I've often wondered that very same thing when you look at how much, and don't get me wrong. I'm not a person that thinks that you should go out and pollute willy-nilly.
I'm a Sierra Clubber.
But when you look at how much that actually reduces, there's probably other things that you could be doing. But I think in California we've made great strides in air quality, and there's always room for improvement. Yes. But I think you get to the point where there's the law of diminishing returns. Mm. And like you said, the law of unintended consequences. And when you switch everything, and maybe a battery powered chainsaw is great for a homeowner.
The homeowner in the backyard for one branch.
For a commercial operation, it's not gonna, where they're going and cutting down multiple trees every day, it's really not that great. The same thing with leaf blowers. Mm-hmm. And I don't like the sound of a gas powered leaf blower at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday any more than anybody else. But when you have a crew that is going through and doing multiple homes, they're either gonna have to charge the batteries off of their truck, or they're gonna have to have a generator with them to charge the batteries. Or in the case of an electric lawnmower, They're going to have to have some kind of a source for the electricity to keep that going. So
we have bags of batteries we carry around now, bags of batteries. And then we get to a client's house, plug in the chargers and get everything charged in between, you know. So,
yeah. So anyway, there are other systemics that are out there with the ban of neonics. And I'm sure there's going to be, as time goes on, more and more replacements are going to be there.
The biggest dilemma too is in terms of those were very targeted pesticides. What do we do for South American palm weevil now? That was the predominant.
I think you have chemical. The homeowners no longer going to be able to do that.
Homeowners can't treat their own things now. So now they're going to pay a professional to do it. Yep. And that's probably the single biggest use of that for palms. The other one, if no one has ever encountered an agave snout weevil, they will take out your agaves. That's the only chemical that works, frankly. Imidacloprid is what everybody uses in botanic garden world. You would lose so many very valuable rare plants, and they get treated all the time. because there's no way to control that pest except for that. So again, what do we use? What's in the toolbox that we can use to take care of some very serious problems?
Yeah.
Yeah. The new one is a, you know, a broad spectrum insecticide, but it's maybe a little too broad, right? Yeah. For some of those pests.
Oh, and I remember the days of acephate. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Smelled so bad.
It was bad. We used to sell orthine wettable powder. And the nice thing about wettable powder was there's no xylene, there's no emulsifier in it. So you can use it on incredibly sensitive plants. And that was our go-to. That was our go-to systemic when it came to ferns and staghorn ferns. And I remember as a kid, we used to carry malathion from, we carried malathion from Ortho, because Ortho made everything.
Speaking of things that smell.
Yeah. We carried malathion from Ortho, and we carried malathion from Chacon Chemical, no longer in business.
Yeah.
And we carried malathion from Cook Chemical.
Oh,
and when we were talking to customers and we were going to recommend malathion for somebody, we would ask them what they were going to use it on. And because there was a difference in malathion at that time, and Cook malathion was water-based. Mm-hmm. It had no emulsifiers, didn't have any xylene in it or no oil. Mm-hmm. So you could use Cook malathion on sensitive plants that you couldn't use orthomalathion on, and it made a difference. Mm-hmm. And those subtleties are long gone now at this point. And it's funny, I think the only ortho product that we have on the shelf right now, other than a couple of herbicides, is malathion. Yep.
Wow.
That's the only one.
My goodness.
And that was, and when you look at the back of the Ortho Problem Solver, they have the catalog of all the ortho products. I counted them up a couple of months ago, I think there was 122 different products, and I think we carried all of them.
Wow!
And there, it's all gone.
I was just informed this week too that the best fertilizer company, which makes Nitro-King, my favorite fertilizer, and Turf Supreme, which is my go-to summer fertilizer, they're moving out of California.
Really?
They are leaving the state, both production, and so that's going to make the price go up, because of course they're still going to make it. But it now has to be shipped into California. So they expect a big price increase.
And probably has to go through some kind of regulatory thing before they can bring it into the state.
Oh,
even though they were manufacturing it here, much like Grow Power.
So thank you, California.
State, right?
When we were talking about Milorganite, when we used to be a member of Home and Garden Showplace, which was a division of True Value, which is also gone now. Mm-hmm. And they used to, in the Midwest, there were nurseries back there that would do promotions of Milorganite in the summertime or in the springtime, and they would sell boxcars of it. Boxcars of Milorganite. But there again, their price was about a third of what we paid for it here in California, just because we had to get it from Milwaukee to San Diego. So you're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I am Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. And we were talking about neonicotinoid or systemic insecticides, and how the general rule of back when it was acephate, you didn't use it on citrus. Saigon, we had mentioned, was available to use on citrus. BioAdvance had a neonic systemic that you could use on fruits and vegetables.
Which was legal for the state of California
until
January 1st.
Yeah.
Right.
And with that going out, I don't think there is any homeowner available systemic that you can use. And talking to our field reps from Bayer BioAdvance, one of the things that they said, that the reason why you could use that is that even though it was systemic, the active ingredient in imidacloprid would not pass from the barrier between, or would not pass the junction between the flowers and the
fruit
and the tree itself, and the flowers, the fruit forming part of the plant. So it would not transfer over.
Well, then that makes me very perplexed. I'm flummoxed because didn't we stop using it as a systemic because of bees, bees gathering pollen?
Correct.
So that's it's not getting into the fruit, why is it getting into the pollen and the flower?
Now, to be fair, that is what the representatives were saying.
Right.
Now, whether that actually plays out or it's not as much crosses over, I don't know.
And that was going to be my question to you guys that have been doing this for several decades here. You know, your feelings on systemics on edible crops.
I've never used them myself.
Right.
But
nor have I. But that said, if you've purchased a citrus tree in the last couple of years, you've used it because you cannot purchase an organic citrus tree.
Ironically, it's been mandated by the state.
Right. The ones that say we need to ban this
because of Asian citrus.
Yeah. And to this day, you can go out in any nursery that has citrus and look at their citrus, and it will have a tag on it that it has been treated per the CDFA requirements to control Asian citrus. So the only chemical out there that I know of that they were doing that with was imidacloprid. Mm-hmm. So and even if they stop using imidacloprid, then they have some other systemic that they are using to treat those trees, to treat citrus for Asian citrus psyllid to prevent the spread of it.
Here's a little segue. We're talking what you can use systemically on a citrus. How about just citrus in general? I have seen more garbage citrus this week than I've seen in a year, I bet. People, take care of your citrus trees. You ought to be ashamed. You should be ashamed. I have seen mussel scale. George just presented me with the cleanest, most beautiful citrus I've ever seen.
Nice. And that's from our garden. Just to say that some people are taking care of their trees. And those are an example.
Well,
and
he did wipe them off for 10 minutes before you got here too. So,
but here's the thing, you know, an unhealthy tree draws more pests. There have been tests at UC Davis actually show that if your tree is under stress, that is like a dinner bill to all these pests. And so you get pests, then that calls in more pests. And so one of the best things you can do, and it's so benign, is use horticultural oil. Please go out, come to Walter Anderson's, buy some horticultural oil, go home and spray your trees above the leaves, below the leaves, on every surface of that tree. I mean, every square inch of that tree I want covered with oil.
And I tell people that regularly, that is because everyone's looking for something safe. It is probably the most benign, obviously, unless there's a swarm of bees on your tree. You know, you're going to harm them if you spray them, but it is the most benign product you can use. It's the most effective for every single pest that's on your tree, with the exception of the citrus leaf miner in the leaf.
Correct.
So it's very effective, especially on scale.
Yeah. And here's the thing too. People are very unaware that if the scale is very, very severe, I just yesterday was dealing with a lemon tree that was losing whole branches. Literally, they defoliated and they were turning brown and drying out because they were covered literally with millions of scale. I could take my fingernail and just rub it across and scrape them off. If your scale is that severe, you're going to lose your tree.
It can kill them.
Yeah. It can kill them. So you need to just get out there and please do it now. It's cool right now. It's the time to do it. And then please do it in another month. And if you're not going to be very, very diligent about taking care of your citrus, can I just ask you, as a real citrus fan, please don't even grow them, because then you are a vector for very noxious, nasty stuff that's going to deprive all of us from citrus.
I want to just go back to his thing about scale, because it doesn't move, it has a mobile phase when it's young, but then it clamps and it's there for the rest of its life. Mm-hmm. People sometimes don't even recognize it. Mm-hmm. And our old manager and I were teaching a citrus class years ago, and we had a branch much like the one you described that we handed to the class. We just passed it around and said, and then we got it back. Said, this is just a citrus branch with no leaves. How many people saw any pest on there? We had one guy raise his hand and we said, what'd you see? He said, there's scale all over it. Mm-hmm. But no one else saw that because it looked just like burbles on the branch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're not aware.
Yeah. So I'm a huge fan of horticultural oil. Mm-hmm. It's not a poison.
Right.
It suffocates the insect. Hence why you say you have to cover the entire tree, because if you don't get it on them, it's not going to do anything.
Right.
And it doesn't
you want
really
some pressure and some vigorous leaf moving.
Yeah. Right. And it doesn't really have it. it doesn't really have a residual to it at all either. You have to coat the insects to kill them. However, if you can coat them with it, it's going to kill them. There and that's the other thing that's nice about it is they can't, unless they can figure out how to live without oxygen, they're not going to get immune to it. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the typical insecticides are
like pyrethrins and things like
pyrethrins
that, right?
And things like that. They affect the nervous system and things like that. And insects can evolve to create a resistance to it, but.
But they can't put scuba packs on.
Until they can figure out how to live without breathing, the horticultural oil works really well. The two go-tos that I use on my citrus at home, and I don't have a lot, is horticultural oil is the main one. Mm-hmm. And I typically recommend people use it 3 or 4 times a year. Mm-hmm. Because citrus is going to have something on it. It doesn't matter. They are going to have something on it. So if you use it 3 to 4 times a year, you're going to keep the majority of it under control. Mm-hmm. It's not going to get out of hand. And then the other one is spinosad.
That's all I use on my citrus
leaf.
And spinosad's kind of it's almost a quasi-systemic because it's absorbed into
it's
the
foliage. It's translaminar. It's slightly into the leaf, right?
It gets into the leaf. And that's why it is effective against leaf miner when the leaf miner is actually present.
Mm-hmm. Because in the larva form inside
it,
the leaf, right?
Yeah, because it can get into it. And it's interesting. If you have citrus leaf miner and you see the damage of it and you go out and spray during warm weather, within a couple of weeks, new foliage comes out and it comes out perfect and it stays perfect for a little while until there's another reinfestation. But the spinosad's a great product.
It's a great product.
Yeah, you get that. It's sold under the brand name of Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew.
And interestingly, the product itself, if I'm not mistaken, was discovered in abandoned rum distilleries in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's a bioproduct.
It is a bioproduct. It's bacteria, like Bacillus thuringiensis.
Yeah, right. BT. Yeah.
Microbial insecticide.
Yeah, it's a good one.
But you were touching on citrus. Were you going to talk about perhaps rats on citrus?
Oh, that's right. That's right. We were going to talk
because
about
I brought
rats
John.
On citrus.
I brought all of us some nice citrus: some Satsumas, some Tangos, and some Persian limes, or sweet limes, Palestine sweet limes. And what was interesting is several. That was an ant on there. When I was picking the Satsumas, you know, you grab them. When I bring them for friends and family, I cut them. When I'm taking them for myself, I rip them off. And when you rip them off, you take half the top off.
Right.
But, yeah.
So when I went to cut one and I was holding it, but there was nothing on the other side.
Yeah.
Because rat had eaten out the other side of it.
Mm. Yeah. There was an article. I should have put the date on this one. I saw this a few weeks ago. Rodents, particularly rats, have wreaked havoc in California orchards and vineyards this year. Some growers have reported yield losses, damage to trees, and destruction of irrigation lines and electrical wiring and other infrastructure. Mm. So it's not just the trees. I mean, they can be a real problem.
They'll get up under your car and eat your wiring in your car.
I think we've talked about that before too. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Rats and other rodents can damage trees by removing the bark, which can cause disease and, if severe enough, kill the tree. And we've seen that too.
Mm-hmm. We have. I just took out an old citrus that was girdled all around the bottom.
Yeah. Wow. Yep. And there's not that much, other than traps, there's not that much available to the homeowner to control rats anymore. And traps are effective.
They are. And there are poisons if you want to go down that road. Yeah. There is, of course, the concern with secondary poisonings.
And that's very real.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah, it moves up the food chain.
But that said, when we hike Lake Poway quite a bit and the Blue Sky in that area, the city of Poway, they have rat poison traps all around their buildings.
Goodness.
So I know that there are bait stations.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. One of the people that interviewed recommended constructing bait station from PVC pipe and placing it roughly 4 feet above the ground by attaching stations to branches. And then he placed stations either 98 feet or 165 feet from each other throughout the orchard. So you don't have to use a lot.
But that is very specific.
Yeah.
Those numbers.
It is interesting. Using 165 foot spacing reduces the cost.
You know, I had it mine 169 feet and they just didn't work anymore.
Exactly. If you the 65 feet, 165 feet reduces the cost, but if efficacy drops about 75%. After knocking down much of the rat population using bait, then they switch to trapping tunnels or snap traps 250 feet apart in the orchard. During a 5-month period, the tunnels further reduced rat activity by 90 to 95%. Wow. So that's a big drop. But you know, the other thing that, you know, it's not just citrus, but rodents will get in, there's a lot of things that rodents will get into, and they'll chew the bark off of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's why you'll have a perfectly nice, Wheeler's dwarf pittosporum is the one that comes to mind, where you get this absolutely beautiful ball shaped plant, and then a big chunk of it dies. And 9 out of 10 times when you go in and you cut that branch out,
follow it back.
There's no bark on it.
Right. And, well, we had that here in our parking lot, that Raphiolepis, the Indian hawthorn, majestic beauty. Mm-hmm. Didn't we have a big branch that died inside there?
Yeah.
And when we followed it back, it was just missing all the bark around one large branch.
That's the thing. You take the bark off of a hardwood plant or a woody plant. That's the end of it. Mm. That's their vascular system that moves everything up and down and throughout the plant. And it's toast. Mm. But that is the telltale sign that you have rodent activity, is where you'll have just a particular branch die out like that. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk. Have a great week. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for joining us on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, your source for gardening, landscaping, and horticultural news. Still have a question for the Garden Talk crew, or want to learn more about the show or how to become a guest or sponsor? Send an email to gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. That's gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. Or visit walteranderson.com. There's more professional gardening advice next week at the same time on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery.